Hey, everybody. I'm back from Edmonton, Canada. Had a nice weekend. It was below zero every day. Well, one day I got to 1 degree and I went out, no pants, and lost the lower half of my leg to frostbite. But you know what? That's how I live, on the edge. No, it was a great time. I was at the comic strip up in Edmonton, Canada. Thanks to all who came out. We had a great time, sold out shows, and see you again when I come back up that way with my sled. And my guest this week is coming up in just a second. Before we get to that, my one-man show, we extended it into March. We're doing shows on March 6th and March 13th. It's called Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak. I've been telling you guys about it. I hope you can come and check it out if you're in the New York area. March becomes a nice, warm month here in New York City, so come on out, check it out. Right near Times Square, go to telecharge.com for tickets. It's Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak. Going through March 13th. As of right now, and my guest, a really interesting conversation with one of the surviving victims of serial killer Ted Bundy. It's a pretty intense story, to say the least, and something a little unique that I think you're going to really find interesting. All right, and hey, please leave some reviews on iTunes about the podcast. Say nice things. Always helps to have some nice positive feedback, so appreciate you can do that, and maybe see you at my one-man show. All right. Thanks, everybody. Welcome to the show, everybody. My guest this week is a very, very fascinating individual who's got an amazing story, incredibly brave. She survived an attack by serial killer and rapist Ted Bundy, and she's lived to tell about it and has a really interesting perspective from it all. Kathy Kleiner. Nice to have you on the show, Kathy.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure. There's something that struck me about this, because just the idea that you can continue to talk about this is amazing to me. You know, and sort of reading up on this a bit, and you, it's you say, you know, you don't mind the movies and the TV shirts, etc. And you say, quote, Bundy was and lived and breathed and did what he did. I think it's good for people to read books about him. They need to know there's evil out there. Why? How did you get to that place where you could be this comfortable sort of, you know, talking about it and having this be, still a part of your life?
When I was first attacked, it was this big, confusing time for me. And over the time when I was trying to recuperate, I realized that by talking about my experience and getting it out of my system really helped me heal. So as the books came out, first one I remember is Ann Rule's Stranger Beside Me. I read it and I wanted to understand Bundy as a person and then Bundy as the killer. So by putting it together for me, I knew he wasn't this big, awful person. He was a person, and I could understand that. And then I understood what he was on the other side. So by talking and reading, I think it helped me recuperate and understand what happened to me that night.
And what did you come to realize about him? What conclusions have you reached about him as a person and ultimately, you know, as this horrific killer?
I came to realize that I was not going to let him define me as someone that was attacked by Ted Bundy. I have so much more in my life that I did and I want to do that I didn't want to be labeled as a survivor, because I've thrived in everything I've done since then. And I have a grandchild, two grandchildren. I have lupus. I've had breast cancer and mastectomy. And I've also had two miscarriages. And I don't know if it's because of the attack or in spite of the attack. I feel very strong that I knew I could get through those other things that were obstacles in my life, because if I can overcome the attack by Bundy, I felt like I could overcome anything as long as I put my mind to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was reading, as a child, you had lupus, and, you know, as you got into childbearing age, et cetera, your mother implored you like not to have children because she was worried about your health. And if I read this right, she like screamed at you when you said you were pregnant or something like that? She got
We actually, my husband at the time and I had a dinner for both in-laws. we had a big cake coming out saying, congratulations, you're going to be grandparents. My in-laws were like jumping up and down and happy. My mother's Cuban and was very emotional. Mm-hmm. And she goes, oh my God, no, you're supposed to, you have lupus. And they said not to have kids. What are you doing? Trying to kill yourself. And she was very upset with me. And part of it was she had to take care of me when I had lupus. I was diagnosed at 13. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of it as well, that she took such good care of me and helped me to overcome that don't do this now. So I think that was part of her not understanding what a wonderful thing it was going to be.
Yeah. Well, I know as a kid too, you couldn't do physical education. You had a certain kind of diet. Did that sort of affect the kind of, before the attack, the kind of person you were growing up to be? Because when you're 18, 19 in college, you're still not a fully formed adult, in my opinion anyway. But were you hesitant about life? Did you walk on eggshells? Like what were you like, or what were you raised to be like, given you had to deal with lupus?
My father died when I was five. Mm-hmm. And I was adopted by my stepfather, and then came into lupus, and it became dormant in me. So I wanted to live life because I was homebound in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make up for that. Mm-hmm. So I joined theater in high school, and I could be anyone I wanted to be. I could be an actress and portray anything and anyone. So that helped me get the feelings out that with lupus that I was tied down and excuse me, and didn't want to, my mama didn't want me to live as much as I wanted to, as far as going out and doing things.
Right.
So I think after theater, and I went to FSU. I was in the state of Florida. And as I said, my mother was Cuban and very protective. And as I looked at different schools to go to, the universities, I was looking at in Tampa at USF. And that's not very far from my mama to drive and drop in for a visit. So at that point, I looked at Gainesville. And I thought, well, it's a little further away. And then I looked at FSU, and that was as far away from Miami as I could get and still get in-state tuition. So a lot of my friends were going there as well. So that's how I picked FSU as the college I had to go to.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah, I grew up in a family furniture business in Rhode Island, and my brother and my sister and I always tried to get as far away from the business as we could. So the night this attack happened, I mean, you were asleep in your room in sorority with your roommate. You heard this thump and Bundy, did he have a log in his hand and he tripped over the trunk or something?
Yes. Our sorority room was really small, like a small dorm room. Mm. And we had two twin beds that were parallel against the walls. And then in the center, we had a trunk. It was a footlocker trunk. And we kept our books on top of it and some other little things. So in the middle of the night, I heard him open our door, kind of creaked a little bit. So I remember hearing that and kind of coming to a little bit. At which time, because our room was dark, he tripped over the footlocker and made noise as everything came falling down. I was awake enough to see a dark figure of a person, just the outline. And I saw him standing there. I couldn't see any face or distinction of anything. And I saw him lift his arm up over his head, and he had something in his hand, which ended up being a log. And he came and thrashed it on my head. He just slammed it on my face. Mm. And at which point I almost bit my tongue off. Mm. My jaw was shattered, mainly in three places. And my cheek kind of opened up from my mouth up to my ear. Mm. So it was a open wound. And they did find bark in it later when I was in the hospital.
And yeah, it went. And are you looking up? Like, are you now? Your face has been bashed. You're conscious still. Are you seeing him, or are you just seeing a shadow, or did you immediately pass out from the blow?
When it first happened, I was laying on my left side, so my right face took the beating. Mm-hmm. And I remember it when he did hit me. It was like a big thud. It was like just I would think it'd be a sharp pain or something, and it wasn't. It was weird because it was a big thud, and I think I passed out at that point, or else withdrew in and kind of just laid there. At which point he attacked my roommate because she became aware that someone was in the room. After he attacked her, he saw that I was still moving and alive. And I don't think Bundy ever left a victim alive. So he came over back to the side of my bed and struck me again with the piece of oak. And he was a shadow this whole time. He was just like a black figure of a man, no distinguishing marks or face or anything I could see. And a little bit after that, our bedroom was on the second floor. Our curtains were open and a car car light shone up into our bedroom. And it illuminated the room. And I believe he thought he was seen, because at that point he left our room, went down the stairs and left the sorority house.
Mm. So it's a good thing you don't close your curtains, huh? Jeez.
It was at that time. That light just was amazing. It just has so many feelings for me for having seen it and having it available to be there.
Do you sleep with the curtains closed or open to this day?
Either.
Yeah.
Usually
okay.
It depends on the weather.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not locked into closing curtains because of.
Yeah. And so, I mean, he was about to finish, so to speak, his business with you when that light shone in the window and he had already attacked and killed a couple of other women in the sorority before he got to you. Isn't that right?
Yes. Yes. That's correct. When he first came up, and the sorority house was beautiful. It was, very southern looking. And when you opened the front doors, straight in front was a beautiful wooden staircase that kind of spiraled around and got to the landing of the second floor. Mm-hmm. And as he did that, the first door on his left was Margaret Bowman. He went into her room, closed the door, attacked her and strangled her with pantyhose, raped her. When he was done, he pulled the sheets up to her chin so it looked like she was sleeping, and went out her door, her bedroom. Right across the hall was Margaret Levy's. And he went into her room, closed the door, and raped her and mutilated her and strangled her with pantyhose. Mm-hmm. And bit her and other things, which actually the bite marks helped to bring him when he went to trial, that it helped to show that he was the one that actually did the attack. Mm. After he attacked Lisa, he came into our room, which was across the hall again, and that's when he attacked us. So Margaret and Lisa were left for dead. However, Lisa was alive when the paramedics got there. She still had a heartbeat, but they could not revive her after that.
Yeah. Did it ever come out in trial, or like why he strolled into that sorority? Was it just a random, you know, that's the night I'm going to go out and do something, or was that sort of pre-planned in advance?
I believe that I know he was at a little bar that was near the sorority house, just a local bar that all the students went to. Mm-hmm. And he was in there trying to dance with women. And a couple of people, women saw him kind of like freaky, and they walked away and didn't want to dance with him. Mm-hmm. A couple women did dance with him. One of the women was leaving there at the bar and walking back to the sorority house. He followed. And he noticed that she went in the back door of the sorority. She just walked right in. She turned the knob, the handle, and walked right in. We found out that the combination lock on that back door was broken. It did not lock. We had noticed it for a couple of days and mentioned it to the gentleman that did the maintenance work around the house, and he said he'd get to it. But at this time, it was not locked. He saw her go into the sorority. He followed, and right next to the back door was a pile of firewood that we had cut to use in our fireplace. That's where he picked up a log and walked through the house, and that's how we got in. And we think he because he wasn't knowing who he was just following someone that left the bar, a woman, and went to follow her.
So, I mean, you've obviously not shied away from trying to understand this person as a person, as a man. And in sort of reading that I've done about him, sort of there's issues of control, you know, sort of whether it's the rape, whether it's the killing is ultimate control, and then even sort of keeping the body parts. Is that kind of where you come down on this with him, or have you gleaned other insight into him in his psyche? You know, I understand you're not a forensic psychologist or anything like that, but you know, you obviously are you know, fairly well steeped in this person. What do you come away with?
I found that it was very healing for me to tell my story after it happened, as well as reading about him as a person. Anything I could find or any story I could hear, I would hear it to try to understand the man that was behind the killer.
And what do you come to understand about him as a man? Like, how do you read him as a man from your understanding or reading of him?
I believe he was very controlling. He wanted everyone to see who he was because of what he wanted to show them. He let only people see what he wanted them to see. And because of that control, I think it helped understand that he could only control that for so long. And then the other side of him, the evil side that was the killer, was able to, he would just turn into being that easily. I think he would just, you know, have some alcohol and drive around until he found someone that he thought he was capable of kidnapping and killing. So at that point, being so in charge of himself, and then being so scary and into killing and mutilating people, I think sooner or later that those two kind of merged. And when, as the years progressed and he was caught and going to be electrocuted, he totally lost control of who he wanted people to see. And I hope in my heart, that he started feeling like the victim, where he had no control of what was happening and just kind of was lost into his evil that he created for himself.
Yeah. After this happened, I know you know, you moved back home and all, and then you had an interesting a comment about it. You hadn't heard from your sorority sisters. You were kind of isolated, I guess. And you said, quote, "I hadn't been around any of my sorority sisters since the attack. They all were moving forward. And here I am stuck in a bubble, me and Bundy in a bubble." What did you mean by that? And how were you feeling at the time?
I think what I meant like that, what that was I was just him and me at this point. It was my family helping me, but it wasn't my sorority sisters who I thought would be there for me forever, and you'd be friends forever. And I kept calling them when I first got home and was recuperating, because I wanted to talk to them, any of them. I just felt like it was important to hear their voice and for them to tell me I was going to be all right, and everything was good. I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. I was just in the room, and I wanted to hear that. I wanted the sisters to tell me that it was good and I was good and, you know, come back. However, no one ever returned my phone calls. As often as I called while recuperating, I would get so sad because I'd leave messages, and, you know, a week later I'd leave another call finally, my mama said, you know, don't keep calling. It upsets you. Just wait until they call you back, which no one ever did.
Wow.
Why years later, I have, well, I found out years later that he, the sorority, Chi Omega, was telling them not to keep in touch with me because I represented Bundy attacking the sorority. And in that light, pledges wouldn't want to come and join the CAIO because of the connection with Bundy. So if they cut the connection, it would go away. And also the sorority Chi Omega wouldn't be making any money coming in because these new pledges would not want to be coming to CAIO. So for those reasons, I was told that they, you know, were not allowed to contact me. When I did see him years later, it was at a funeral that we, for one of the girls that I knew, they came and they hugged on me and they were just all around me. And I pushed them away and I'm like, you know, where were you when I needed you? I don't need you now. I'm here, you know, for my friend Susie who passed and I don't have a place in my life for you now. And I walked away from them and it didn't make me feel good. It just made me feel strong.
Well, I probably would do the same thing. What I don't understand is, okay, so you're saying that they were still sorority, they were still in college and still in the sorority when you were reaching out to them fairly soon after the attack. That's a horrific thing for them to not call you back and for the sorority to tell them that. But then what about when you're 22, 25, 27 and they're out of school? You didn't hear from anybody. Did you continue to reach out into those years or did you just say, listen to your mom and say, you know, they ain't calling back. I'm done with them.
Over the years, it is odd because for the last couple years since forever after the attack and a couple years later, I've gotten letters requesting money from the alumni to help with doing things around the sorority or helping with scholarships. And when they do send their letters, they're handwritten. So they find me. I mean, I've lived in four states since then, and they find me everywhere. And not once did one of those letters say anything personal about me or to me. It was just asking for donations from the alumni.
It's just mind-boggling.
And as far as the system, I know. And now my husband tries to intercept the letters because it makes me mad, yeah. You know? So over the years, you know, I just got one actually just recently that they were doing a scholarship in the name of Margaret and Lisa. And I thought, you know, that's really good because spreading their name out there still continues to help people, even though, you know, they had passed and were taken away from us far too soon, that the sorority was allowing their name to be continued. So I thought that was a good thing. And I just got that like 2 weeks ago, handwritten with my maiden name and my married name here to my house. And it was just like, you know, how do they keep finding me when they could have found me anywhere at any time? I know that one of the sorority sisters did create a victims of crimes for the state of Florida so that they would have an outlet to talk and they could talk to them and help them through it. I never once heard from this sister or any of the others that were working with that they had started.
What could you possibly glean as the explanation for for these people, A, not reaching out to you and then B, when they do, not acknowledging what happened to you? Is it because it was such a dark event that it upsetting to them? Or do you think as time went on, they felt so guilty about not reaching out to you that they felt it was easier to not reach out to you than to acknowledge that they should have earlier? Like, have you thought about I can't imagine if you were my sorority sister or frat brother that I wouldn't reach out to you right away and try to help you. Like, what, anything come to mind as to why you think they acted that way?
In the beginning, I think they did because the CAIO sorority told them to, and as time went further away, they started continuing with their lives and what they were doing, and you know, their dreams and whatever they had, they were moving forward. And to say I was in a bubble with Bundy, it was something that was within me and around me all, you know, all the time, but they were moving on. I don't think they even thought about trying to contact me or anything. I just think I became a memory. And then as far as they could get away from me, it was better for them.
Yeah. And you went back and visited the sorority and walked through. Why did you do that? Was that for closure? And what were the feelings like when you were walking through the house?
When I was in the hospital, I was a week in the hospital for a week after the attack. I was going to fly back to Miami on a small plane. The police were escorting me. They did not know it was Bundy at that point. They just knew that an assailant had come in and attacked all of us, and they didn't know who it was. So in the hospital, actually, I had a policeman at my door who was there constantly to make sure I was safe. But when I was leaving Tallahassee, the police officers took me back to the sorority house into the room, and they wanted me to look to see if anything was missing, if I could tell, you know, anything that let them know that he had taken something, or in case they did find him, they'd have something to look for. And I remember walking really slow up the stairs, and my mouth was wired shut in three places. And my tongue was, as I said, not doing anything. And it was very traumatic for me to walk up those stairs. And the police officers were like holding my arms and helping me. When I turned the corner to go down the hall, there was yellow tape around Margaret's door, crime scene. And also I looked and there was some around Lisa's door. Then they walked me to my door and there was crime tape everywhere. And they lifted it up for me to go through. And in the room, it was very traumatic to look at. There was blood everywhere. It was on the ceiling and the wall next to my bed. And it was all over the brand new bedspread I had gotten just a couple of weeks earlier for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And there was blood everywhere. And where there wasn't blood, there was the black dust for taking fingerprints. And it was just way too emotional for me to be in there.
Yeah.
And then they asked if I ever used red nail polish to fix a run in my stockings. And I was like, no, that was an odd question, I think, for them to ask. So after that, it seemed like I was there hours, but I'm sure it was just a couple minutes. I remember walking out and looking at my bedspread again and feeling so upset after all it's going through, that my bedspread got messed up. And it was just kind of an odd thing to put in your head. I was just, so just not knowing what was going on, that seemed important. So when I walked past Margaret and Lisa's room again, and I saw the yellow tape, that's when I found out that they had been attacked as well. No one told me when I was in the hospital that there were other sisters that had been attacked that night.
And what was the significance of the question about the nylon with the fingernail polish? Was that a pantyhose that he used and they thought it might have been yours or something?
Yeah, I really don't know. I don't know if it's something he'd used in the past or at this point, they still didn't know it was Bundy.
Right.
So I think they didn't know to look at it in different areas or if it was the same stockings that he carried around in the room or, you know, how that was going to be used. But, you know, for them to ask that, I just thought it was odd. There was a lot of odd things going on in my mind in that room that day.
It's not to make light of it, but the fact that you would be so upset about the bedspread is an interesting reaction. well, you know, as we wrap up here, there's one quote that really struck me, and it's, you know, this phrase is used a lot, inspirational, but really you are. I mean, you say, referring to this, obviously, it made me stronger. It gave me more to live for, and it taught me nobody's going to put me down. I just think that's incredible, and you've been able to hold on to that your whole life. It seems like have you ever had periods in your life where you've just gone into a deep funk or depression, and has it overwhelmed you, or have you been able to stay as strong as you sound that you are?
I don't feel like I've gone into a dark space. when right after the attack, and I was in a confused state of mind, I came up with, this is ugly and in front of me, but if I take one step away from it, it goes one step away from me. And I kept doing that in my mind. I would take little baby steps because that's all I could do. And in my mind, every step I took forward, this went behind me a step. And that way I feel like I walked myself out of the feelings I had and out of that situation. And I went, whoa, you know, I can do this. So I can do anything, you know. And later on, as I was diagnosed with the breast cancer and miscarriages, I found that, you know what, I can step away from this also. I can walk one step further and put this one step behind me until it's something that I experience, but it's not going to define me.
Mm. Well, it's incredible. And I think you're incredible. And I really appreciate you talking about it. It gives people a perspective on how to look at, you know, setbacks and horrific events and deal with it. You're a mother, you're a grandmother, you're a breast cancer survivor. That's all the good stuff. So I appreciate you being on, and I know you're working on a book about this, and it'd be interesting. I know you weren't interviewed for the Ann Rules book, and I'm hoping maybe you write one, and I think it would be really inspirational for people. So I appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a good talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. Have a great day. Thank you. Kathy Kleiner, everyone.
Well, there you go. That's Kathy Kleiner. That was that's quite a person, I'll tell you. Unbelievable. Hey, listen, one-man show happening. Telecharge.com, Paul Mercurio's permission to speak. Come check it out in New York City, and leave some nice reviews on iTunes about the podcast. Always helps. Thanks, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you next week.